Good afternoon. Good morning. Perhaps the best way, or the best way I know, to read this Genesis from chapter 12 through to chapter 50 is to go back to the tribal groups in Canaan and just imagine them telling stories as they came into their sacred site. Might be Bethel or Beersheba or Jerusalem, of course, but they're telling their stories from way behind history, oral tradition. Writing seems to have entered into the what we'll call Palestine, in the Northern Kingdom in the 700s BC. This goes way behind that. So what do you tell stories for? Storytelling is an art that every culture has, and the idea of telling the story is to reinforce values of your contemporaries. And everyone kind of knows the general outline of the story, but a good storyteller can give it colour and interest that others can't. And so it ends up with this long oral tradition of hand. No one's keen to say the same thing in the same words, because so what? The new words come in and new interests, and it's alive and relevant to the people. So I'm going to now do with you five chapters of Genesis, the beginning of the patriarchal period, and it's all about Abram. Did Abram exist? I don't know. They don't know. Nobody knows. But in the story, that isn't what matters. What matters is these are the values of our ancient tradition, going way back, 1,000 years before any written document. So you can imagine what life goes on with that. So we're not looking for historical fact here. We're looking for an understanding of the faith of Israel, Judah, and from which Christianity too emerges at the time of Jesus. So let's start. We've now got a written record of that oral tradition, a particular record of it. It starts in chapter 12, and it's the call of Abram. It reads, Yahweh said to Abram, go from your country and your birthplace and your father's house to the land that I will show you. I will make you a great nation, and I'll bless you and make your name great. Avram means great father. I'll make your name great so that you will be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you and curse those who curse you. And to you and all and in you, all the families of the earth. Don't miss that. All the families of the earth. This is a universal blessing, shall be blessed. In the letter to the Romans, chapter 4, verse 16, Paul picks this up and says, Abraham is the father of us all. Everyone. From the outset, going back to chapter 11 now, we're in chapter 12, but we read this morning. From the outset, we're told that Abram's wife Sarai, princess, was barren and had no child. So that's what we're presented with. And here's Abram being given this enormous promise. Paul reflects that the Lord is the God, again, quoting from Romans 4, who gives life to the dead, equivalently dead, unable to give life. But God can give life. And he calls into existence the things that do not exist. the author of the letter to the Hebrews writes, Abraham received power of procreation, even though he was too old and Sarah herself was barren. As the authors of Genesis set out to retell the ancient stories of Israel's ancestors, they want their readers to see their God creating Israel, the nation, out of nothing, as his instruments to bring God's blessing to the whole world. Then put yourself, the returned exiles, where this is being written down and circulated and spoken out. This might seem impossible to the returned exiles who do not possess the land and have found the temple in ruins. Their ancestors were blessed by God. They too did not possess the land. Their ancestors, and they too had no temple in which to worship. The covenant God made later with Moses had set out conditions that the people had to fulfill. The people failed, hence the destruction of the city, and hence the exile in Babylon, as they understood it. The authors are reminding their contemporaries that God, long before Moses, made a promise to their ancestors. A promise that was not dependent on anything they could or could not do. A promise given by the one whose designs are not dependent on human capacity. And in verse 1, the promise to show Abraham a land. The promise is renewed in verse 7. In the center of Canaan, Yahweh says, "In your offspring, I will give this land." So let's look at the text. So, Abram went, as Yahweh had told him, and Lot went with him. Abram was 75 years old when he departed from Haran in Syria. Abram took his wife Sarai and his brother's son Lot and all the possessions that they'd gathered and the persons whom they had acquired in Haran, and they set forth to go to the land of Canaan. When they'd come to the land of Canaan, Abram passed through the land to the place at Shechem. So in the middle of the Israel, it's the north mountain range. He went to the Oak of Moreh. At that time, the Canaanites were in the land, the author reminds them. Then Yahweh appeared to Abram and said, "To your offspring I will give this land." So Abram built there an altar to Yahweh who had appeared to him. And from there he moved on to the hill country at the east of Bethel, a little south, and pitched his tent with Bethel on the west and Ai on the east. Ai is a tell. It was destroyed centuries before this time, but there's just a heap, what they call a tell, an ancient city that's just not there anymore. And there he built an altar to Yahweh and invoked the name of Yahweh, and Abram journeyed on by stages towards the Negev. The Negev is the southern part of Judah, basically desert. So he's working his way south through the land that, as they see it, God promised them. The next scene, I won't read to you, I'll just tell you the story because you're probably familiar with it and there's not a lot I can get out of it for you, is Abram goes down into Egypt. It's chapter 12, verse 10 to 20. The point I'm making is Abram in Egypt faces two crises, both of them familiar to those living a nomadic life that's dependent on the seasons and powerless against those who own the land. Faced with a severe famine, and this used to happen all the time, he decides to migrate to Egypt, because Egypt had the beautiful Nile River and had enough food for Egyptians and a lot of other people as well. However, going to Egypt means that he and all he owns are at the mercy of the most powerful ruler in the world, who can do whatever he wants. That's the Pharaoh. The story, chapter 12, focuses on the worst possible situation. If the Pharaoh thinks Sarai is Abraham's wife, he will kill Abraham and take her into his harem. He can do that because he's the Pharaoh. What will happen to the promise of God if that happens? If he loses Sarai? How can he be the father of many nations without her? Abram hasn't yet learned to rely on God. So he does the only thing he can think of doing, and he pretends that Sarai is his sister. So if the Pharaoh can take her by all means, but he won't need to kill Abram to get her. So he pretends it's his sister. That may save his life. What else can a powerless nomad do when faced with a ruler who can take as a wife for himself whomever he chooses? That's a reference right back to chapter 6, building up to the flood. These heroes of ancient times could do what they want. However, the situation is saved by the Lord, who sends a plague, as they see it. The next scene, chapter 13, again, I'll just tell the story and you can look at it later or remember it. Abram leaves Egypt and he passes through the Negev, that's the southern part of Judah, and he arrives near Bethel, some 40 kilometres north of Jerusalem. And the text says, there was strife between the herders of the livestock of Abram and the herders of the livestock of Lot. And Abram said to Lot, beautifully generous Abram, let there be no strife between you and me and between your herders and my herders, for we are kindred. Is not the whole land before you? Separate yourself from me. If you take the left, I'll go to the right. If you take the right, I'll go to the left. So choose. But let's part, because it's not working. Lot chooses the left, that is the Jordan Plain, the river, etc. And that leaves Abram in the hill country in the land of Canaan, which is all God's plan, as it were, being worked out here. There's another little etching by Gustave Doré of this separation. The text goes on, 13, verse 14. Yahweh said to Abram after Lot had separated from him, raise your eyes now. Look from the place where you are, northward and southward and eastward and westward. For all the land that you see, I will give you and your offspring forever. This is the dream. Of course, it has a lot of unfortunate repercussions even still today, as you well know. But the strict Jews reckon, no, the whole land is theirs. So there's nothing wrong with getting rid of all the Palestinians, as Joshua got rid of all the Canaanites. He didn't, but that's the story. So they've got this promise of this land forever. I'll make your offspring like the dust of the earth, so that if one can count the dust of the earth, your offspring also can be counted. Rise up, walk through the length and breadth of the land, for I'll give it to you. So Abram moved his tent and came and settled by the oaks of Mamre, which are at Hebron, just south of Jerusalem. And there he built an altar to Yahweh. Paul, in his earliest letter, the letter to the Galatians, chapter 3, writes, God granted the inheritance to Abram through the promise. He'll see it spiritually, of course. Many of the people reading this text don't. Then there's a campaign, a war, and there are four great kings, and they engage in battle, and in that battle, it's in chapter 14 if you want to read it later, Lot is taken prisoner. Abram enters to fight on behalf of his nephew, and he defeats the kings and rescues Lot. And one of the kings is from Salem, which of course later we'll call it Jerusalem. And that's the famous Melchizedek, and this is the only time he's mentioned here. So King Melchizedek of Salem brought out bread and wine. He was priest of God Most High. He blessed Abram and said, blessed be Abram by God Most High, maker of heaven and earth, and blessed be God Most High, who has delivered your enemies into your hand. And Abram gave him a tithe, it's the beginning, a tenth of everything. This strange, enigmatic figure, Melchizedek. And you can see how the New Testament picked that up and carried forward, particularly in the letter to the Hebrews. Then comes a critical scene. It's chapter 15 and it reads, the word of Yahweh came to Abram in a vision. Do not be afraid, Abram. I am your shield. Your reward shall be very great. And Abram said, O Yahweh, what will you give me? For I continue childless, and the heir of my house is Eliezer of Damascus. The house is a unit, a family unit. This is one of the slaves. He's got his wife, they're pregnant. So that's the best Abram can do. So he says, otherwise the heir of my house is going to be Eliezer of Damascus. You've given me no offspring, and so a slave born in my house is to be my heir. I know you're not forgetting this is a story, and a story that's handed down in the traditions of Judah. The word of Yahweh came to him. This man shall not be your heir. No one but your own very issue shall be your heir. So Yahweh brought Abram outside and said, look towards heaven and count the stars, if you can. Then he said to him, so shall your descendants be. And Abram believed Yahweh, And Abe and Yahweh reckoned it to him as righteousness. He put his faith in God's word. And that's used in both Galatians and Romans by Paul. The story continues to enlighten. Then Yahweh said to him, I'm Yahweh, who brought you from Ur of the Chaldees, so to give you this land to possess. On that day, Yahweh made a solemn commitment to Abram, saying, to your descendants I have given this land, from the river of Egypt, that's a river somewhere near the Sinai Peninsula area, it's not the Nile, but it's another river there, to the great river, the Euphrates. And that sets up this picture of hope that their promised land goes as far as the Euphrates. It never did. It never got there, but that's their dream, based on how they understood God's promise to their ancient ancestors. And now we begin a very intriguing and, I think, amazingly intricate history. The history of Hagar and Ishmael. Ishmael is the founder, in their view, of the Arab peoples, so clearly very important to Islam. And Sarai, or will become Sarah, and Isaac. It's the last two chapters I'm going to do with you this morning, but it will be continued tomorrow. The story takes up quite an important mass of material because it's considered so important. The Hebrew scriptures present God as making a special covenant with Abraham and choosing to overturn cultural expectations by achieving his purpose not through the firstborn son, that's Ishmael, but through the second son, Isaac. And this often happens in the biblical story. God isn't confined to human practice of giving the land to the firstborn son. We may do that. That may be our custom, but it's not God's. God's always full of surprise, and we have to wait on God's promise, and God chooses whomever he wills. And in this case, he's going to will to carry on the promise that he's made, not through the firstborn Ishmael, but the second Isaac. So Abram was the father, becomes the father of Ishmael and Isaac. The people of Israel came from the blessing given by God through Isaac. The Arab peoples came from the blessing given by God through Ishmael. A careful reading of the Hebrew scriptures, which I hope to do with you now, clearly shows that God's choice of Isaac did not involve a rejection of Ishmael. Abraham never rejected his firstborn son Ishmael, nor did God. On the contrary, God blessed Ishmael in a special way. I think this is important for us to read the text so carefully here because of the fraught relationship between the Jews and the Muslims. And according to the text here, the Jewish text, that's a tragedy. There's no need for it. Because God blesses both very beautifully, as we'll see. Genesis 16 begins. Now, Sarai, Abram's wife, bore him no children. We've heard that. She had an Egyptian slave girl whose name was Hagar. And Sarai said to Abram, you see that Yahweh has prevented me from bearing children. Go in to my slave girl. It may be that I shall obtain children by her. So Abram listened to the voice of Sarai. So, after Abram had lived 10 years in the land of Canaan, Sarai, Abram's wife, took Hagar the Egyptian, her slave girl, and gave her to her husband Abram as a wife. He went in to Hagar, and she conceived. It's quite a custom in their day, of course. When Hagar saw that she had conceived, she looked with contempt on her mistress. She started to look down on her anyhow, because she couldn't have children. And Sarai said to Abram, "May the wrong done to me be on you." She blames him, even though she organized it. "I gave my slave girl to your embrace, and when she saw that she'd conceived," the text goes on, "she looked at me with contempt. May Yahweh judge between you and me." But Abram said to Sarai, "Your slave girl is in your power. Do to her as you please." Then, we're told, Sarai dealt harshly with Hagar. It's exactly the same term used in the book of Exodus for the way the Egyptians treated the slaves of Israel. She dealt harshly with her, and Hagar ran away from her. Comment: Sarah gives her servant to Yahweh, but is envious when her servant conceives and deals harshly from her. With her. The text continues, "The angel of Yahweh." Now, in this ancient literature, there's no angels and devils. You've got to kind of get that out of your mind. That's an Iranian influence that's quite late in the Hebrew Bible, mainly in the Greek parts, the late Greek parts of it. So forget about devils and angels. When the angel of Yahweh is mentioned in this literature, it means God himself. But because God was transcendent and doesn't immediately impact on us, the angel of Yahweh is their way of speaking about God as God deals with us, the angel of Yahweh. It comes into the New Testament too, as you know, in the Annunciation scene. It's not as if God doesn't come to Mary, but rather sends one of his, inverted commas, archangels in this case. That isn't the point. The Lord, God is speaking to Mary, but they still keep this tradition of distance or transcendence, mystery. So they call about the angel of the Lord spoke to her. Well, here it is here anyhow. "The angel of Yahweh found her by a spring of water in the wilderness." This is Hagar. "The spring on the way to Shur. And he said, 'Hagar, slave girl of Sarai, where have you come from and where are you going?' And Hagar said, 'I'm running away from my mistress Sarai.' And the angel of Yahweh said to her, 'Return to your mistress and submit to her.'" And the next verse, "The angel of Yahweh also said to her," and don't miss this because it's very important, "'I will so greatly multiply your offspring that they cannot be counted.'" My glasses aren't working too well. Is that for multitude or something? For multitude, thank you. Now, there are echoes here of the promise made earlier to Abram, which I've got here in black. "Look toward heaven and count the stars, they shall, so, such shall your descendants be." So there's a blessing here for Hagar and her offspring, similar to that of Abram. The angel of the Yahweh said to her, "Now you have conceived and shall bear a son. You shall call him Ishmael," which means Ishmael is God. God has heard your cry. God is the one who always hears the cry of the poor. "For Yahweh has given heed to your affliction." The text continues, "He shall be a wild ass of a man," Ishmael, "with his hand against everyone, and everyone's hand against him, and he shall live at odds with all his kin." So she named Yahweh, who spoke to her, "You are El-Roi," for El, God, Roi, see. "El-Roi, for," she said, "have I really seen God and remained alive after seeing God? Therefore, the well," and this will come back, "will be called Be'er Lahai Roi." Be'er, or Be'er, Beersheba is a well. Lahai is to live. Hai is live. And Roi is see. So, Be'er Lahai Roi means the well of the one who lives and sees. It lies between Kadesh and Bered. Hagar bore Abram a son, and Abram named his son, whom Hagar bore, Ishmael. Abram was 80 years old when Hagar bore him Ishmael. So the promise of God is working, and he has now a son. So we're led to believe here that well will appear significantly throughout the story. Genesis 17. "When Abram was 99 years old, Yahweh appeared to Abram and said to him, 'I am God Almighty. Walk before me and be blameless. And I will make my covenant," my commitment, my promise, berit, "my covenant between me and you, and will make you exceedingly numerous.' Then Abram fell on his face, and God said to him, 'This is my solemn commitment to you. You shall be the ancestor of a multitude of nations.'" I'm stressing it, but you've got to keep seeing it in the text. And that's what, to jump ahead, that's what gave Paul the energy for what he did. Because what had happened is Abraham was becoming the father of the Jewish people. It's too small. And so they had their cults, and they had their circumcision, and they had this and that. And when Jesus entered the temple, it's because the temple was too small. It belonged to a sect or a group or a nation, whereas it's meant to be the multitude of nations. And when Paul saw that, he could pick up the whole of his faith and gear it to expanding through the world, where he never asked anybody to be anybody else. The Scythians were Scythians, and the Romans were Romans, and the Greeks were Greeks, and they didn't have to become a Jew in order to be part of this ancient dream now being realized by Paul and others. So back to our text. "You'll be the ancestor of a multitude of nations. No longer shall your name be Abram. Your name shall be Abraham." And they're two dialectic words for the same thing. They both mean high father. But the change of name indicates a change of mission. "For I have made you the ancestor of a multitude of nations. I'll make you exceedingly fruitful. I'll make nations of you, and kings shall come from you. I'll establish my solemn commitment between me and you and your offspring after you throughout their generations for an everlasting commitment, covenant. To be God to you and to your offspring after you. And I'll give to you and to your offspring after you, here it is again, the land where you are now an alien. All the land of Canaan for a perpetual holding, and I will be their God. So a promise of future and land. The text continues, and now the practice of circumcision, which the Jews practiced, other nations did as well. Circumcision is an important... how will I explain it? In the very act of giving life, of course, the penis is very relevant to that. So the injection, as they understood, of life into the female, every time that happens, every time the future comes, every time the hope is there, they're aware through circumcision of this covenant. So they can't forget it even in the most intimate moments of their life-giving. God said to Abraham, as for you, you shall keep my covenant, you and your offspring after you throughout their generations. This is my covenant which you shall keep between me and you and your offspring after you. Every male among you shall be circumcised. And God said to Abraham, as for Sarah, your wife, you shall not call her Sarai, but Sarah. And again, they're two dialect words for the same name. But the change indicates a mission. Just as Peter was, Simon was called Paul, sorry, Saul was called Paul, and Simon was called Peter. And for many religious orders still do that, going way back to the Benedictines, they get a special name when they make their profession for the same reason, to indicate a new, like Therese of Lisieux becomes Therese of the little child and the holy face. Don't forget the second bit. So that's part of her spirituality, or Elizabeth of the Trinity and so on. It's a beautiful practice, really. I'll bless her, and moreover, I'll give you a son by her. I'll bless her, and she shall give rise to nations. Kings of peoples shall come from her. Then Abraham fell on his face and laughed. It's a story. Well, Isaac means laugh. That's the one that's going to come. So the laugh is fitting with the word, that's all. And he said to himself, can a child be born to a man who's 100 years old? Can Sarah, who's 90 years old, bear a child? Abram said to God, this is lovely, oh, that Ishmael might live in your sight. God, and something strange is happening here, but don't forget my firstborn boy, Ishmael. Oh, that Ishmael might live in your sight. A comment. When God promised Abraham that Sarah would bear him a son, Abraham pleaded, oh, that Ishmael would live in your sight. And God replied, as for Ishmael, I have heard you. I will bless him. I'll make him fruitful and exceedingly numerous. He shall be the father of 12 princes. And I'll make him a great nation. But my covenant I will establish with Isaac. God can choose as God wills to choose. And those 12 princes, I'm sure you can see a parallel with the 12 sons of Jacob, the 12 tribes of Israel. There's an echo here of God's first words to Abraham. Go from your country and your kindred and your father's house to the land that I will show you. I'll make of you a great nation, and I'll bless you and make your name great so that you will be a blessing. I'll bless those who bless you, and the one who curses you I will curse, and in you all the families of the earth shall be blessed. The point they're making, the blessing that God gives and chooses to give through Isaac doesn't take away the blessing that God gives to the firstborn Ishmael. And the text continues, your wife Sarah shall bear you a son, and you'll name him Isaac. I will establish my covenant with him as an everlasting covenant for his offspring after him. As for Ishmael, I have heard you. I will bless him and make him fruitful and exceedingly numerous. He'll be the father of 12 princes, and I'll make him a great nation. But my covenant I will establish with Isaac, whom Sarah shall bear to you at this season next year. Then the story goes on, all the males, according to the law, are circumcised. And Abraham is 99 when he's circumcised, and Ishmael, his firstborn, is 13 years old. And Isaac hasn't been born yet. While the Hebrew scriptures are clear that God made a special covenant with Abraham, and that God chose to overturn cultural expectations by achieving his purpose through Abraham's second son, Isaac, as the child of promise, this in no way replaced the covenant made with Noah, in which God expressed God's commitment to all the peoples of the earth. Furthermore, the choice of Isaac did not involve a rejection of Abraham's firstborn son Ishmael, nor of the Arab peoples. Abraham never rejected Ishmael, nor did God. On the contrary, God blessed Ishmael in a special way. Now, conclude this beginnings of our journey, Genesis 17, verse 20. As for Ishmael, I have heard you. I will bless him and make him fruitful and exceedingly numerous. He'll be the father of 12 princes, and I'll make him a great nation. And my comment is, note the echo in God's commitment to Ishmael of God's first words to Abraham. Go from your country and your kindred and your father's house to the land that I will show you. I will make of you a great nation, and I'll bless you and make your name great so that you will be a blessing. In you, all the families of the earth shall be blessed.